questions that could reveal your purpose in life? What if there were questions that could surface the change most meaningful to you? And what if answering those questions would give you the power to ignite? Welcome to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. These are big conversations that lead to self-discovery. Together, let's embark on the leader's journey and ignite meaningful change. We commence the leader's journey by meeting Jonathan, who, upon agreeing to play the game changer publicly through this podcast, cautioned me, "I'm not a leader." As you listen, you may hear him reveal otherwise, whether he recognizes it or not. Welcome to London, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you for making the trek.
It's good to be here.
Good. And thank you for being willing to experience the transformation of the Illumify Game Changer. Let's start with telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I was born in 1970 in Nottingham, England. Nottingham being the home of Robin Hood, the great folk hero, and who, in a strange way, is a hero in Hollywood and in great cartoons and great children's stories, but strangely not so celebrated in our city. 1970, it feels like a different world compared to where we are today, and I'm sure we'll come back to that. I grew up in Nottingham, and let me jump to the experience that I think is probably most important in my childhood, and it's where I discovered language and languages at school. And for reasons which I still don't understand today, 53 years later, I became fascinated by the French and German languages. And they were some of the few subjects at which I genuinely excelled at school. And I pursued them all the way through to university. And that, I was probably too young at the time to say that these were decisions. They were not decisions. I couldn't possibly have understood how important they were going to be. But as I look back now, they were incredibly important, and they set me on a path which led, I think, to where I am today with you. And that passes through 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, which for me still today stands out as the towering landmark of my life. The moment that gave me hope. It was one of the many moments where I fell in love with Europe and the idea of Europe. And that has been a constant throughout my professional life, but I would say my personal life as well. I worked in Europe's political capital, Brussels, from 1995 until 2020. And that was the city, Brussels, where I had the great fortune of combining my political passion for Europe with those skills that I had learned at school, namely language and in particular the French and German languages. So I had the great privilege of finishing my time in the European Commission. So this is 2015, 2016, as the speechwriter for the then president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. And I was very lucky. And I guess it was one of those moments where everything that you had done before came together and made sense. I left Brussels in 2020, in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of a lockdown, with my partner, Elizabeth. It was we called it Bold Moves. That was our slogan. That was our T-shirt slogan for that year. We both felt instinctively, deeply, that we needed to leave Brussels for very different reasons. I'd been there for 25 years. And we sat down one day and said, it's time to go, isn't it? And Copenhagen was the obvious choice. It seems crazy to say that, but it was the obvious choice because we had both fallen in love with that city. We'd visited Copenhagen many times, and I know this city is dear to you as well, Marianne, for your own reasons. And we had gone through Copenhagen visiting Liz's family who live in Sweden. And I knew that we'd be happy there. So we're now three years into our new life there, a transition. But I feel that we are today where we should be. Still with challenges ahead, but we are where we should be.
How do you know that, Jonathan?
I think you have to trust in the choice that you've made. We're always telling each other stories. We're telling ourselves stories. We tell ourselves stories about how we ended up here. And the story I think that Liz and I are telling each other is that it makes a lot of sense that we're in Copenhagen. If we think of what matters to us, our values. Here we go. I'm going to put my political cards on the table right now.
Good.
Liz and I are, I think to use the traditional European terminology, Liz and I are both social democrat with various tinges and nuances around that. There's a liberal streak in both of us. There's a conservative piece of me that I've discovered in recent years. There's a very deep green part of me, which I've discovered because of the ecological crisis that we find ourselves in. All these different colours coming to the fore as one ages. But I think Liz and I both feel we're in a city that corresponds to these values and where we are able to be who we want to be. So I think you feel it. You feel that you are in the right place for now.
Thank you. I'm conscious in listening to you that you made brief reference to the fact that you were a speechwriter for the president of the European Commission. Many people, and I know a lot of speechwriters, that is the most defining thing about themselves, and yet for you it's not. As well, you haven't mentioned yet what you're doing in Copenhagen, and there is a linkage between the work you did in Brussels, particularly in speechwriting, and what you're doing. So I'm curious as to why the W word hasn't come up.
Okay, I'm not going to guess now what the W word is, but yeah, of course, writing. Yeah, absolutely. Probably the biggest part of my transition in Copenhagen took place about 18 months ago, so the beginning of 2022. Not coincidentally, it was around the time that Russia invaded Ukraine. I'm sure we will come back to this at different moments in the conversation. For the record, I believe it's important to say that, strictly speaking, the invasion did not begin in February 2022, but in February 2014. And that brings me to your question. This was the moment where I decided to start writing fiction, and that it was time to try to write my first novel. And here we are now, 18 months later. I have a first draft completed. It's in the cupboard waiting to...
Wow, first draft. Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind.
No, that's a major achievement.
Thank you. I have a first draft. I'm going to come back to it when I'm ready for lots of different reasons. I'm not quite ready now. But the reason for writing this novel and the choice of subject is very much in line with what you were talking about. Europe has been my passion for the last 40 years in different ways. And I wanted, I've always felt very deeply that, and I say this with you now, Marianne, in the middle of London, and that's not a coincidence either to what I'm going to say now. I've always felt that we have not yet found the language in Europe to talk about this, I believe, wonderful and miraculous political and cultural project that we began after the war. And so in my...
After World War II.
Correct. Yeah. This is dangerous. Many, many writers, including the writers I deeply love and respect, caution any writer about writing about their politics. I'm profoundly wary of the traps which await the writer who seeks to express her political views. So I'm walking that tightrope, but I feel it needs to be done for me, because I do believe that we've not found that language, and we do urgently need to find a way of talking about Europe, the Europe that we have today, which does justice to the vital importance of what we're trying to do here. Vital, and I say this in 2023, with all the events that are going on around the world at the moment, from Ukraine to Israel. Vital because I feel that our democracies across the West are perhaps more fragile and more under threat today than ever before. So that's a very long answer to your question about why I'm writing and what I'm writing. It's a novel about Europe. It's called Mother Europe. It's about...
I love that you have a name for it.
Well, a lot of writers find the title first. You start with a title, and that helps you along. It gives you it reminds any writer, I think, why you started out on this journey in the first place. And I think mothers throughout history are often, I mean, my mother's the hero of my life, but also I think mothers in times of conflict and war are often the heroes that we don't talk about. We rightly talk about the soldiers on the front line who give their lives. And I say that today on the 11th of November, a special day in this country's history and European history, Armistice Day.
And in Canada.
And in Canada, of course. But we often forget about the mothers. And I, just to finish on this point, if I may, because this was when you're writing something, it's when you look back, it's incredible to remember the moments of inspiration that caused you to start writing. And I remember seeing an absolutely brilliant exhibition of art in Copenhagen about 2 years ago. And it was, the entire exhibition was devoted to the paintings and drawings of women over the last 100, 150 years in, I think, if I remember correctly, mostly European history. And there was a German artist, Katie Kollwitz, who I'd never heard of before. And I have rarely been so moved by what is in fact a very simple charcoal sketch called Brot, bread. And it was a mother whose back is turned to us. We don't see her face. We know that she's poor. We can guess that she's poor from her clothing. And with her right hand, she's struggling to control her son, who seems to be struggling with her. And with her left hand, we see her pointing down to a young girl who could only be maybe 2-3 years old. And what you see on the daughter's face is just incredible. With the slightest and deftest touches of a chunk of charcoal, Kollwitz had painted hunger, despair in the face of this young child. And I think that was the day, I think, when I got the title for the book, Mother Europe.
Thank you for sharing that, Jonathan. I was going to ask you, given that writing a book is such a massive, all-consuming commitment, why you chose to, and you've answered that in advance so brilliantly. So thank you for that. I'm going to ask you what may be an unfair question, which is, when you look around, given, you know, the years you spent in politics, supporting politicians, really, right? Looking at the state of the world right now, how do you feel about it? Do you feel that there's a chance? Does democracy, for example, do you feel it has a chance?
Yes. I've always been an optimist. I remain an optimist and an idealist. I have no illusions that this is perhaps, it feels like the most profound and urgent and worrying crisis facing democracy, certainly in my lifetime. It feels at the moment as if we might be heading towards a global conflict, because there are people who I think want that precisely. My faith in democracy has come from my own experience in Europe. If we look at what the European Union is, I think it's the demonstration, a living proof that humanity can reach the darkest depths of depravity and do the cruelest things to each other and still somehow come through that and then put in place the institutions to make sure that it never happens again. I have no illusions. The European Union is not perfect. It has made mistakes. It will continue to make mistakes. But what we have shown to ourselves, first and foremost, and I desperately hope over the next few years that all Europeans, from Lisbon to Kiev and from Copenhagen to Athens, will simply appreciate the value of what we have built together and how lucky we are to have this, and that it's so worthwhile defending. And the question will be, do we have the will to defend it? And I think that begins with a recognition of the dangers facing it. I have been deeply encouraged by the wealth of popular support for Ukraine across Europe, not only at the level of prime ministers where you would expect it, but in the street. Walking around London this morning, I see Ukrainian flags in the same way that I see them in Copenhagen. One of my favorite places in Copenhagen is the Central Railway Station in the middle of town. And if you walk into that railway station today, the entire concourse carries both Danish and Ukrainian flags. There must be something like 30 or 40 huge Ukrainian flags decorating the roof of Copenhagen Central Station. It's a wonderful sight. So I do have faith in democracy. I think we will come through this, but we're going to have to wake up, I think, to the threats that are there now, and perhaps closer to our borders than we think.
Thank you. So it's very commendable that you see the world as it is and you know, are enough of an idealist or optimist to believe that there can be some change. Is there something you sense that you can do to help? Because it's, you know, there are many, Jonathan, who observe, maybe even complain, but are never compelled to act. Do you feel compelled to act in some way?
I do. And I think each person has to find their own way of doing it. I talked about Katie Kollwitz earlier, great German artist. She produced these very simple drawings and paintings and sculptures as well, which have already changed my life, and I'm sure they've transformed other people's lives as well. And she went on to become a campaigner in the 1920s for a reconciliation between France and Germany. She had understood, I think, the risks of not going down the path of reconciliation, and she was, boy, was she right. So art, I think, is part of the answer. I look, this is going to sound like a crazy change of subject, but I look at my football team.
Which is?
At Nottingham Forest.
Oh, of course.
To the people who don't know Nottingham Forest, we won the European Cup twice in succession, 1979 and 1980. And we're seeking to rediscover those days of glory. The reason I mention it, though, there is a serious point here. Over the last two or three years, I've seen how a football club can understand its place in the community, understand how it can inspire not only its supporters, but the citizens of the city. And over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've watched, often from afar, from Brussels, where I used to live, and now in Copenhagen. So I can get back home 3 or 4 times a year at best. So I'm often watching this on my TV screen. But what I've seen is grassroots political mobilization, the club and its supporters supporting the homeless, for example, players sleeping out with the homeless, the club making a very clear statement about its intolerance of racism or any form of xenophobia, its strong support of the LGBT community in Nottingham. And I say this to answer your question because, for reasons which are very complex, I think a lot of our political parties and a lot of our political leaders are failing at the moment. And in those moments, this is where society steps up and where we have to start lifting more of the load, perhaps. And the two examples I've given, art and football, different though they are, do have the capacity to mobilize and move people on a large scale. We will need political solutions, but I think perhaps today more than ever, society needs to mobilize itself in defense of democracy. And I think we will. I think we will.
I suspect a lot more will come out about that. Jonathan, what does the word leader evoke in you? What do you see? What do you feel?
Big question. I confess that because I had some time to think about what we were doing today, I asked myself the question, who have been my leaders, or the people I have identified as being leaders? And the person I would go to make this a very clear, to give a human face to this conversation, I would probably say Martin Luther King, because I think he represents so many things, but in the context of the conversation we were just having there about the future of democracy and our ability to live together side by side in spite of our differences, and to find ways to not only share power, but share our wealth, our resources, our good fortune, but also to be there for each other in times of misfortune. I mention Martin Luther King because he most obviously stood for the dignity of his people. We identify him rightly with the fight for human dignity and human rights, civil rights in America, in the name of his people. But he went beyond that. He had a vision of America. He had a vision of America which transcended race. It's not that he was denying the importance of race. How could he? How could he, of all people, do that? But he transcended it, and he had a vision of America, I believe, and I would want the same vision to apply to Europe. And I think it does apply to Europe today, when Europe is at its best. And that's a vision which says that we live together first and foremost as equal citizens within a community. And our racial identity, our sexual identity are important, but they do not define who we are. I can't speak with great authority about Martin Luther King. It's before my time. I only have the great recordings of his great speeches and the history books and what I read of other people's accounts of Dr. King. But this idea stands out very clearly for me about his leadership, his vision of leadership and what he brought to America at this critical juncture in that country's history. This vision that we live together as equal citizens of a community and we are not defined by our individual characteristics, our individual identity, be that racial or sexual or other. And I think that's absolutely fundamental.
I love that you chose him as your example. Of course, his speeches endure, even now, still considered top, really. But I also love it because he's a prime example of a significant, of a meaningful change. And he had a vision that was way ahead of his time, really. It reached a state, I think, for him where it was intolerable, but he could see what could be that was not yet. And it's interesting that he expressed that vision so magnificently and that it's still being realized. It has yet to be realized. It's a massive change, but it is incrementally, my hope, bit by bit by bit by bit, being realized. So, wonderful example of a leader. I will add, though, this work in the Illumify Game Changer is about igniting meaningful change. And meaningful is a relative term. It's specific to what matters to you as a leader. And, you know, he is an example of the ultimate, I would think, in terms of societal change. But know that your own significant or meaningful change doesn't have to measure up to his to matter. So let me ask you now, what is your perception, because you have been so willing to experience the Illumify Game Changer? What's your understanding of it, given it's new to you? Coming in, what do you think this will be for you?
I think, and I'm going to try to answer this having listened to you, Marianne, and what you have said about it. I think you have been deliberately and rightly mysterious about it, which I understand.
Mysterious, I love that.
I understand that and respect that. You said to me, we're going to jump into the unknown together. And
we're going to jump into the unknown together. Ooh, I don't remember saying that. I love that.
Yeah.
It really does sound like something you'd say.
I guess it does. And by the way, that is finally Catherine's voice in this. We together, Catherine Pisana and myself, have the honor of facilitating Jonathan's play of the Illumify Game Changer. So, hi, Catherine.
Hi. Not to worry, my questions are listed.
I figured, yes. I saw you writing notes.
So, yes, you've hinted what it's about. I think what I'm expecting, or perhaps what I'm hoping for, is it's maybe it's maybe a couple of things. Part of me thinks that change is not out there somewhere waiting for us along the path, and one day we reach it and we stumble into it, we catch our toe on it, or we notice it by the roadside. Oh, there's change. But that actually it's somewhere already inside us, and what we're trying to do is find it. And I say that having listened to various writers talking about how they write, and I've always loved this image of a good story being something which is already there. You don't invent it. You don't create it. It's already there. It's hidden underground. And your job as the writer is to dig it up carefully without damaging it, and to dust it off and to lift it out of the ground so that you can see it and hold it in your hands. I think it's a lovely image about what writing is. And it seems to fit now. It seems apt now as we talk about what this conversation might be about. And then I think the second part of my answer here to this question of what we're trying to do here and where I think this conversation will go, this comes down to a core part of my own personal philosophy about the good life and how to try to live the good life. And that's the very simple idea that we can achieve none of our major projects and missions without the help and the support of other people. And I would say that if you really boil this down to its fundamental level, I would say that we cannot become our true selves without the relationships that we have, starting with our family and friends, but also work colleagues and people that we meet throughout life. We only become our true selves through our relationships with other people. And so turning to this conversation now and what we're trying to do here, I sense that you are not simply going to prompt me to dig down and find that story about leadership and what it means and how to ignite change, but that this will be a conversation, because I don't believe that we can change on our own, whether that's professional reasons or in our personal lives. I think we may come back to this later. I don't want to go too far into this now, but I sense this is one of the paths that we've gone down in society over the last two or three decades, and which feels like a mistake. And I have no doubt we can correct it. But I think certainly in our Western societies, so Europe and North America, there is often a sense that we merely need to look inside ourselves to find the answers. Look inside yourself, do what feels right for you, and you'll get there. And I just don't think that's true. I think we are profoundly dependent on each other, not just for friendship and companionship and solidarity, but in this search to find our true selves and to be, therefore, as happy as we can be, we need each other. So that's how I imagine our conversation is going to be.
Do you have any expectation? I mean, commendable, first of all, that you're willing to do this, given it's so mysterious. And secondly, you flew in from Copenhagen to meet us here in London and have committed your time to doing this. So any expectation?
I think if we think about expectation as, because I don't want to imagine or predict what's going to happen, but let me perhaps see an expectation as something that I would like to happen. What I would like to happen is that with your help and through the conversation we're going to have and the questions that I know you have spent many years thinking about and refining, I hope that I can begin that work of digging inside, not this time to write a story, but to use your words, Marianne, ignite change. I do feel that I've arrived at a moment in my life where I need change. It's a moment of transition. Copenhagen symbolizes that transition. And even though I've been in Copenhagen for 3 years already, I still feel that I'm very much at the beginning of that transition, and that the real change is possibly still to come. There's my little piece of mystery for you.
Good for you. So one last question from me before I turn you over to Catherine's extensive list of questions here.
I ran out of papers.
Oh no, she ran out of paper. Do you see yourself as a leader, Jonathan?
No. I'm saying that deliberately to be controversial. It might mean that this podcast ends in the next 30 seconds.
I can assure you it won't.
But you advise me rightly, I think, to speak from the heart, and I am. And if I've not seen myself as a leader so far, even though I know my partner and my friends and my family would possibly point to one or two examples where I have been a leader of sorts, if I say no now, it's because I want to speak to something deeper, which is I have often seen myself as somebody who works behind the scenes. It's not great language from a writer. It's a bit of a cliche, but people understand what it means. I've often been happy to be the one writing the words, but not necessarily the one presenting them to the outside world, to the audience. I think also I grew up with a sense that I was an introvert, and I think I still am an introvert. I'm somebody who's very happy to be in a crowd, very happy to be at a party, very happy to be in a big meeting of people, but who can sometimes become silent in those situations and finds it difficult to interrupt and win my own space within that group. So if I say no to the question now, that's, I think I'm speaking to a sense that I've had throughout most of my life, and where also perhaps my sense of ambition is more internal, that we can strive to do great things. We can strive to be the best of ourselves. We can strive to be creative. We can strive to join the teams and the communities and the causes that we believe in without necessarily leading those moments, those movements. So I don't say it with any sense of modesty, but simply, I hope, out of a truthfulness about who I am and how I've lived my life. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. My follow-up, though, is could it be, because you were very quick with the no, I must say, could it be a no not now, or could it be a no, I haven't found what I want to lead just now? Could it be no, not ever?
I think what I can say for sure is that I do feel that I have things to say. The book that I'm writing is perhaps the most visible example of that at the moment. But I know that in the politics that you and I have talked about and the big challenges facing Europe at the moment. Yeah, I have a very strong desire to be part of the battle, and it is a battle. I think that's the right word. I think the battle to defend our democracy, our democracies over the next decade and beyond. I want to be part of that, and I do feel that I have things to say. I think, coming back to your question, there's one more thing I would say about the question of leadership and whether I see myself as a leader. I think I grew up in a period, if I look back to the 80s, when I was a teenager, I think there were a lot of very stereotypical, cliched images of leadership. They were often very, very macho images of leadership in any part of life, not just in the economy or politics, but across many parts of social and cultural life. And I think I rejected that because I knew from a very early age that I was just not a macho man in any way. And that's not going to change. So I think that's part of the reason why certainly in the earlier years of my life, I think I rejected what seemed to be the prevailing view of what leadership was for men, certainly. I think that sounds very outdated now. If I look at our Western society now, whether in Europe or North America, that feels very outdated, because I can look across wide swathes of our economic, political, cultural, social life in Europe and North America, where I think, thankfully, women are very present and increasingly present in roles of leadership, which is not just good, but fundamentally necessary. And that's another conversation that we may come back to. So, again, if I'm saying no to the leadership question, it's. I think I'm looking backwards here to my path so far, and perhaps looking for the reasons why at different moments I rejected the obvious forms of leadership. I've always been deeply passionate about politics, but never saw myself as an elected politician, for example. And I don't think that's going to change. But let me hang on to this, because I do feel very strongly about this. I do feel I have things to say, and I want to say them. And sometimes you have to fight your way to the front of a crowd to say them.
Well, the connection between leadership and language, saying, writing, is a direct relationship. Almost, it is the way that you're able to express leadership that can have almost ultimately the impact. There's more to it than that, of course, but the fact that you have now repeatedly referenced, first of all, giving others the words, you know, in writing, speeches. And I will say, Jonathan, I spent much of my life in what are called the back rooms. I didn't want to be visible either. I was giving my clients, leaders, the words and the strategic counsel. There may come a time, though, that any of us have to choose whether being in the back room is sufficient. And so what I'm hearing you say, and this is not to put words in your mouth, is that you're also recognizing that what was past may not be true today, and that you are open. This is a method of surfacing. It's a method of inquiry, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Catherine, do you want to start making your way through your list?
Yes, with pleasure. Thank you. Jonathan, your words are very rich. And not only do they all hold quite a lot of substance, you weave them together in a way that speaks to every individual in the audience differently. And there were some sentences, some phrases that you used that were louder to me than others. So I'd like to take a look at some of those now, starting with something that you said about stories. And I'm paraphrasing here. You said something along the lines of, we always tell ourselves stories. And it feels like this thread of story is very poignant and significant on your journey. Tell me, how do stories influence will?
I think this comes down to how I would see political change. If we stick with political change for the moment, this has been a big part of our conversation now for the last 10, 15 minutes. If we stay with that, I think stories are fundamental to our ability to change the opinion of other people and bring them with us. I think stories and metaphor are the tools which allow us to change not just the nitty-gritty and the detail of policy, but actually change our priorities as a society. And perhaps over time, begin to change our values as well, or at least open our hearts and minds to other values. I think story is a fundamental part of that because it's emotion. I want to bring the word emotion in here because there has been a prevailing view for years now, I would say, and I'm saying this in London now. Let me give you a very tangible example of what I'm trying to say here. As you know, a few years back, this country voted to leave the European Union, and the people who were most distressed and disappointed in that result, the people who wanted the United Kingdom to remain within the European Union, would often say, "Ah, but this was a huge mistake because it was an emotional vote. People were voting with their emotions. They weren't thinking through the issues. They were denied the facts by a populist government. And if we'd had the facts out there and if people had voted on the basis of facts, then everything would have been okay." And I think that's a profound misreading of what happened. I think it's a profound misreading of what politics is. And it comes back to this question of story. Our great neuroscientists today, so the women and the men who are unlocking the secrets of the human mind, and we're only scratching the surface here. We're only at the beginning of what I think will be a fascinating journey of discovery into the brain and the mind and ultimately consciousness. The neuroscientists of today are confirming what many of our great philosophers discovered hundreds of years ago. This is all very complex, but I'm going to boil it down to its most simple idea. We have understood for hundreds of years that human beings do not make rational decisions because we're human. We are not capable of doing that. What we do is we decide instantaneously in milliseconds and less than milliseconds. Some people would say from the gut. We make our decisions from the gut instinctively. And then what our rational mind does is it writes the press release. Our rational mind gets to work very quickly and very busily at writing the rational justification for the decision that we've already made from the gut. And my sense of this is that when we're making these decisions, it's not just about whether we go to this shop or this shop, or whether we turn down this road or this road, that the regular decisions of every day in a city, but our deepest, deepest moral inclinations, our moral judgments obey the same principle. And the reason I'm saying this in response to your question is that if we, whether it's in politics or in any other part of our social life together, but certainly in politics, if we want to change other people's minds for good reasons, I'm talking about mobilizing people behind a political project that we believe in, then we have to use stories, because we have to speak to people's emotions and we have to understand the parts of stories, the ingredients of stories that speak to people. We will never win any debate with facts and figures, and we will never convince our friends or enemies with facts and figures. It's simply not how we work as humans. So I think at that most tangible, practical level of politics, I think that's why story is so important.
What happened to humanity in 2020? Specifically as it relates to its capacity to receive story and its tendency to translate it or interpret it. What happened to humanity in 2020? And does that inform how the resource or the tool of story has to change, if at all, to reach them?
Are you, Catherine, when you mention specifically 2020, are you looking at that year for any particular reason, or?
The beginning of the narrative.
Yeah.
That is this global pandemic that has affected all so much.
I think the problem here is that in spite of what I've just said, there is no shortage of story in our world today. And again, I'm going to confine my answers to those parts of the world which I know best, Europe and North America. I've never lived in North America, but I've visited the United States many times and have a deep affection for many parts of that country and its culture. I grew up like any British boy or girl, watching vast amounts of American TV and cinema, and then discovering its great writers later on. But if I say this, it's because there is no shortage of story in our world today. The problem is not the shortage of story. I think the problem that we have, and this goes beyond our democratic crisis, it goes deeper than that, I think. I think we have lost our ability to distinguish between fact and fiction. And perhaps also, and this is more worrying, we've perhaps begun to lose a sense of why that really matters. Okay? Now, at the most obvious level, this is about propaganda and disinformation. And I think, sadly, and my hope is that it's not too late. I don't think it is too late. But we do have to be aware, I think very, very quickly, of the damage that's been done through disinformation. And if we have been vulnerable to that, there are many, many reasons. I talked about story, and I put heavy emphasis on the need for emotion in a story, if you want to convince people, if you want to mobilize people, if you want to bring them into your team. And it sounded perhaps as if I was denigrating fact, that's not true. Fact, factual reality, and our ability to describe it remains as vitally important as ever. My point was simply to argue that it's not enough, that you can never win an argument or convince people through fact alone. But facts themselves remain absolutely important to our shared reality. If, and I've just finished rereading George Orwell's 1984 again, if as a society we are not able to agree that 2 + 2 = 4, then we go down a very difficult and dark path. So story is important, but factual reality and our ability to share it and agree on a factual reality is absolutely vital as well. And I think what we've seen over the last decade, for lots of different reasons, I think we in the West have lost our ability to distinguish between fact and fiction. And it's tragic for me, this is my personal view, it's tragic because I think we are undoing some of the great solutions and tools that we discovered long ago to help precisely with these challenges. I'll give you one example, the newspaper. The good old-fashioned, old-school newspaper was a brilliant invention and a brilliant response to a very urgent question, which is, how do we know what's going on? How do we know what's going on at the other end of our city? How do we know what's going on in our neighbor's city? How do we know what's going on in the other side of the world? And how do we trust the people who are telling us what's going on? And the newspaper was a brilliant invention to that, and there are still great newspapers around today, and I think they are perhaps even more vital to our democratic future today than they've ever been. But again, we in this moment of crisis, we have to remember why they were such a brilliant invention. And this is where I have a view of our democracy as something that's very corporeal, very bodily. If you look at Europe's democracy, but I would say North America's democracy as well, over the last 100, 200 years, a faltering, sometimes failing journey, but ultimately one, I think, which will prevail. What do we see? We see human beings putting their bodies on the line to defend democracy. And the newspaper symbolized that. Women and men who were willing to risk their lives to get to the truth in a war zone, in a corporate boardroom, investigating the local mafia, investigating the local corrupt politician, where they were risking their lives. They were putting their body on the line. So our defense of democracy ultimately is a bodily, physical necessity. And I'm saying this almost to counterbalance what I was saying earlier about the power of words, the power of story. History teaches that in the end, that's not enough. You do have to be willing to put your body on the line as well. So to summarize again, in answer to your question, I think what's happened in recent years is that we don't have a shortage of story. There is story everywhere, from our streaming services who produce amazing films and series. We've just been through the golden age of television. I believe that. Stories on social media. People are still reading books, believe it or not, in 2023. So we have no shortage of stories, but I do feel we have to rediscover a much clearer sense of why the truth matters and how we get to the truth every day in our social and cultural lives. Because the two things have to coexist. We need any democracy and any civil society needs great stories that move people and mobilize them and make them believe in values, make them understand what really matters in life. but we need to agree and share that factual reality at the same time.
You use the word true a lot. I like that. When we look at the concept that you've brought up about true self, two questions here. One is, well, first of all, let's go into the background. So you said, and again, paraphrasing here, that it's only when we engage in relationships with other people that we learn about our true self.
Yeah.
When we're not at that stage, when we are not able to identify that version of our true self, with whom are we engaging when we engage with ourselves?
I think every human being goes through an inner journey, which can be very lonely, when we are only engaging with ourselves. In spite of what I've said, I think we do rightly, inevitably look within ourselves for the answers, and there's nothing wrong with that. Of course we do. The examined life, what is the examined life? The idea that we first perhaps discovered with the Greek civilization 2,500 years ago, the examined life in some ways is a lonely journey of introspection and asking oneself the big questions. I think for a lot of people who follow a particular religion, it is also a very personal journey where they may have a relationship with their God through their faith and their prayer. But I imagine it's also something very personal to them and deeply within them and inside them. And I think I sense that as somebody who is not a believer in that traditional sense and who doesn't follow a particular religion, an organized religion. But I do think that we have to look inside ourselves as well. Does that begin to answer your question? It's a difficult question.
It is a difficult question. It's interesting because one of the ways that I was reflecting on approaching it is, what is the opposite of the true self? If the true self is something that we can discover, that implies we haven't discovered it yet when we begin the journey. And so with whom are we having our relationship if it's not with our true self? Is there a false self?
Yes, I think there is. I think there is. And I'm gonna drop into the conversation here a word which occurs to me right now, and I think is very apt to what you've just said, this idea of a false self. And that word is crisis.
Nice.
Because I think crisis and change often go hand in hand.
Oh dear.
I'm going to name check somebody now who's had a big influence on my thinking over the last few years. I'm going to say he's an Anglo-Irish poet, if I remember his family background correctly. A man called David White. I've not met him, but I've listened to him very often. And he talks very eloquently about crisis and the nature of crisis. And he speaks to something that you've just said, Catherine, and this comes back to the question of story and the stories that we tell ourselves. David White sees crisis as a weather front. He has a great image of a weather front. So we might imagine a clear sky, but the approach of clouds that are darkening, the prospect of rain, maybe the wind is starting to pick up. And we sense that the weather is changing. So there's a front, and two things are meeting. When we experience a weather front, two weather systems are meeting, often cold air and warmer air, and that's what produces the turbulence and the change. And for David White, the idea of crisis is that it's a moment where two things are in direct confrontation. The story that we have been telling ourselves up until now, so that could be the story we've been telling ourselves for
and
the last...
perhaps have acted upon.
Absolutely.
Consistently.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And a story which is necessary for the reasons you've just given, Marianne. We need the story to act and to have a sense of where we belong and who we are. So it's part of our need for our own sense of identity that we tell that story. And I think we all have that sense that as we look into our past, as we walk through life backwards, I forget who said this, but we sometimes have this sense of walking through life backwards with our back to the future, and we look constantly into our past. And I think that makes sense if you think that we're always revising and rewriting the story of ourselves. We do that. And that's because we need to hang on to this sense of identity and who we are. So David White says that in this moment of crisis, that story, the story that we've been telling ourselves for a long, long time, comes into confrontation with something else. And it's the moment where the world tells us the story of who we are. And that confrontation, that conflict, the inevitable abrasion that comes with that when these two fronts meet each other, it can't end happily. It can't end in amicable agreement. There has to be turbulence here and crisis. And then after the crisis, change. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I these are images, metaphors, but for me they work, and I hope that perhaps they do for you as well.
Oh, yes, they do. I was just imagining something interesting. Wouldn't it be fascinating if there were a visionary in this world who was able to tell stories in a way that reached people, and those stories were all about how to deal with this crisis? Not only that, they were what ignited the crisis. Does that sound like an attractive job?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you've just said there, Catherine, I think is that's why I have loved fiction. But if I'm honest here, I would say cinema just as much.
To the movement part, the action part.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I've never believed that cinema was either inferior or superior to the novel. In the same way that I have always believed that pop music and rock music, when it is great, can be just as powerful as a Beethoven symphony, because what's happening here is it's change happening at a level which is not articulated.
Is that?
Through the word, through the written word or the spoken word, but at a much deeper level. I mean, the novel is the written word. But what I'm saying here, I think, is that it's the deep metaphor in all of art that produces the change and puts us in touch with the sublime, the transcendent, the other that we sense is just beyond our grasp. We know it's there. We're not quite sure what it is, but art at its greatest, whether that is a pop song or a Beethoven symphony or a great novel, it unlocks a little door into that other world momentarily.
And to bring cinema back to vision for a moment, I once heard an interview with Quentin Tarantino, and he was talking about the challenge of being a film director. He had no challenge with vision. He always began with a vision. But initially, he was challenged by how do you put that vision on the screen? So in the interview, he spoke about meeting with another director, just happen chance. And the first thing you want to know from that highly revered director is, how do you put your vision on the screen? And the way he tells the story is that the director said, well, you see what should be there, and you have other people do their part. And those other people have the expertise, the whatever that may be, maybe it's technical, maybe it's political, maybe it's financial, whatever it may be, it all comes together and realizes, as a collective, realizes that director's vision. And as soon as he saw that, heard that, he said, oh, I can do that. Can you relate to that?
I can. I can, if only because it speaks to my deep admiration for Tarantino, but also the other great directors of our time. And what I find particularly impressive about cinema, and listening to you talk about it there, Marianne, it's this, it's the ability to marshal a large group of people around your vision. Who has not been struck by the credits at the end of a film, which just go on and on.
Even when we don't know what some of them mean, like yeah. Best Boy, I still don't get that, but there you go.
Exactly.
Yes, Marshall.
And the grip. What's the grip?
Right. What's the grip? And when you say Marshall, you've alluded to this a number of times already, Jonathan. With respect to change, whether it's personal change, as you said, or political or whatever type of change, you're recognizing that it takes a collective to achieve it. And sometimes even on the personal front, it takes a collective, a group. And so when you use the word marshal, and I love that, you know, words that convey action, I love. And as a speechwriter, you know that, right? But to marshal others, to me, gets to the unify portion of Illumify, which is, you know, Illumify is to illuminate what matters, make it clear, and not everybody can see it. So if you're a visionary, that's where first you start by being clear about your own vision, and then you start to express it to those who can help you realize it. And yes, you express it in verbiage, words, that's the amplify, story, facts that ground it, make it credible. But then, even when you illuminate brilliantly and amplify it so that those who can help you realize it, get it. It's equally meaningful to them, so much so that whether they have to or not, they choose to help you realize it, to achieve it. Even that, if you're talking a group, whatever size group that is, whatever size collective that is, the ultimate then is to unify them so that they act in alignment and think to whatever degree about what that is. Similarly, and story helps shape that. You alluded to values and beliefs, etc., so that you share a common background of understanding on what that is. A falseness aside, but in unified, that is where, in marshalling, you ensure that they think and act congruently and consistently in alignment. Because if they don't, they're going scattershot off in all directions.
Yes. And you've just used a great word there, Marianne, which I think, sadly, this is a word that went missing from our political language in Europe and North America, I remember politicians using it with great enthusiasm and energy. 20, 25 years ago, they were still using this word. And you've just used it now talking about cinema. You were talking about Tarantino and his quest to this question that he faced. How do I put my vision on the screen? And that word, vision, is one, it's gone missing from our political language. I couldn't tell you the last serious politician who stood up and said, this is my vision for the future of our country. I can't remember the last person.
I can tell you that maybe it was 10 years ago now, I had a client who was ultimately an ambassador to the UN, but prior to that, he served for 10 years as a federal cabinet minister in Canada. And he was running for re-election again, and I was one of his advisors. And I said to his campaign manager, what is his vision? Election was coming up. It had just been called. It was 6 or 8 weeks out. What's his vision? And the response I got was literally, he doesn't have time for a vision. Pretty pathetic, really. Tragic, even.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're right. It's been missing from that political vernacular for sure for a long time.
And I think it provides a bridge to what we were just talking about there. Catherine, if we go back to what we were talking about 10 minutes ago about story, and why story is important, the stories that we tell and listen to with other people, but also the story that we find within ourselves. Mm. And now you, Marianne, talking about vision, a visual vision, an audio-visual vision in cinema, for example. And I think that there's a bridge here between these two things. And this is perhaps why that word martial comes in and makes sense. A sort of a bringing together of ideas and resources and energy and people, yeah, ultimately people, a bringing together of all parts of a mission around a common sense of what matters, a common sense of what we're trying to achieve, and all of that wrapped up in the emotional language that will get people excited and get them willing to make sacrifices. Sacrifice their time, which is the most precious resource that we all have. And as we know, sacrifice more than that as well, if needed.
And I will add to that, Jonathan, thank you, that I see this every day. It's very easy to assume that when you see something, others do as well. And so from a leadership perspective, if you see the opportunity or even the need for a meaningful change, you can't maybe see it fully, but you have enough to see what could be, right? So you go talk about it, and you can harness or marshal others to help you. Sometimes they report to you, you know, if you're in a corporation, a hierarchy. But the false assumption is they see it too. And when you have a vision, it is incumbent on you to be able to express it. And sometimes, and to an amplitude, so that others can, they won't see it fully, but enough to start to compel them to want to see more. So the biggest risk I see to any leadership, one of the biggest risks, I should say, is that, you know, leaders charge off, they've got a vision, and they just charge out. We're going to change this. And then people get maybe a little bit excited, but then when it comes down to the hard work of igniting that change, and it can be hard, they think, well, why are we doing this? I don't get it. You know, fine, we're fine the way we are. So he thinks or she thinks it could be better. I've done it this way, we've done it this way for years. Vision is a really important thing in leadership, vital, vital, vital to igniting change. I'm Marianne Gobet. Thank you for accompanying us on the leader's journey. To fully experience the passage to igniting meaningful change, subscribe to the Illumify Game Changer podcast. To learn more about the Illumify Game Changer and how to embark on your own leader's journey, please visit Illumify's website at illumifyinstitute.com. You matter. Step up. Speak up. Together, let's ignite meaningful change.